The Second World War ended, the veterans came home and resumed their lives, the economy boomed, and so did the birth rate. The baby boom generation was one of the most consequential in American history, featuring big growth in population, but also huge changes in technology and education and politics and on and on. Only now are the boomers retiring, leaving the stage. Our guest this hour provides a sharp critique of the accomplishments of the generation. Helen Andrews is the author of Boomers, the Men and Women Who Promised Freedom and Delivered Disaster. Helen Andrews is a senior editor at the American Conservative. She was previously the managing editor of the Washington Examiner magazine, and her essays have been widely published in a number of other places. Helen Andrews, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Sure. Let's start with the title, Disaster. Ouch for the boomers.
That's right, and the irony is that they had such good intentions going into it. But I'm a millennial, and there's no one better placed to point out all of the flaws and the damage that the boomers have done than their own kids.
Right, because this is the generation that really gets the immediate effect. But, you know, you list the effects fairly far and wide. Early in the book, you talk about how the baby boomers killed the family wage, broke the nuclear family. This is just two starting points.
Well, and part of that was the result of something that the boomers are, bafflingly to me, still very proud of, and that was the sexual revolution. The boomers decided that individual desire was the most important thing and that they would sacrifice their marriages to it if need be. And, of course, that seems like it must have been a lot of fun for them, but it looks a lot different from the perspective of the millennials, many of whom are the children of these broken families. And the legacy lives on today, as you see in the fact that so many millennials are going unmarried right now. Something's just broken about the sexual bargain in America. Fewer people today are getting married than at any time in American history. So that's a big sign that something is wrong.
All right, so that explains the claim that the boomers broke the nuclear family. What about killing the family wage? How do you see the boomers responsible there?
Feminists of the boomer generation wanted to liberate women to enter the workforce. And in many ways, that was a laudable goal. I'm a woman who has a job, so of course I'm grateful that I'm able to do that. However, the boomers took it a step too far and said that having a full-time job was the only way to be a fully self-actualized person. A lot of millennials would dissent from that and say that staying at home is actually a perfectly valid life choice. The trouble is a phenomenon that Elizabeth Warren calls the two-income trap, and that was a result of the boomers' choices. They rushed women into the workforce, and the result was that it simply bid up the price of middle-class amenities so that today many millennials feel they need both partners in the workforce just to make ends meet. So that's a frustration for us, that it was possible for the boomers to have a middle-class lifestyle in a one-income earner household, whereas for us, two-income earners are needed just to make it into the middle class.
Because we have up-defined a middle-class lifestyle?
Well, that's the irony. No, the middle-class lifestyle today is the same as it was back then. It just costs a lot more. Ah. And the reason it does is that so many women entered the workforce in the 1980s, but that caused the amenities of the middle class to be more expensive because more families could afford them. So the middle class hasn't changed. It has just gotten more expensive.
Helen, it appears from what you're saying that the book does have a model, a work by Lytton Strachey in the early part of the 20th century called Eminent Victorians. Was there any thought to calling this Eminent Baby Boomers or something like that?
There was a thought, but my publisher thought that not enough readers had heard of Lytton Strachey, which I suppose is fair enough. But the reason I chose his book as a model was that he did his generational broadside in the form of profiles. And that's what I thought would be best, because I didn't want to write a book that descended into just vaporous generalizations. I wanted to keep it concrete. So I picked six individuals who I thought were representative baby boomers, who captured something about their generation. But I kept it concrete by looking at people.
I noticed Lytton Strachey chose four people, and as I think it's your wording, the people who'd gotten the country into such a mess deserved a shellacking. This is just as World War I was coming to a close. He chose four people. You chose six. Talk about the process of choosing. I mean, there's so many baby boomers, so many notable baby boomers. How did you whittle the list down to the six you ended up with?
First, I excluded anybody who I thought there was just nothing left to say about them. And that crossed out somebody like Bill Clinton, who in many ways is the quintessential baby boomer. But I just didn't think there was anything to be said further about him. That topic has been exhausted. I wanted to get a good spread because the boomers have affected every sphere of society. They have left nothing untouched. So I picked Steve Jobs from the world of technology, Aaron Sorkin as from the world of Hollywood, Sonia Sotomayor, Al Sharpton, the economist Jeffrey Sachs, and the pundit Camille Paglia. So that covers the academy, entertainment, the law, politics, a good diversity of topics was my goal.
You definitely got samples in a couple of different fields here. As we head to the break, I just want to ask in general, did you think the boomers did more damage than previous generations did, generations that got us into world wars, for example?
Yes, because there were so many institutions that they inherited in good functioning condition that they failed to pass on to my generation. They were a generation of institution destroyers.
Every time I look at the numbers, even though I'm part of that generation, Helen, I'm fairly shocked. I mean, 2.9 million births in the United States in 1945, 4 million 9 years later, and it kept going up for quite a few years after that. The boomers really did feel like they owned the world when they were young.
Which is why it's only natural that they may have developed a little bit of the vice of narcissism. Because the fact is that from the moment the boomers came of age, they have been the most numerous generation, which has meant that advertisers chased their dollars, politicians courted their votes. They've been the most important generation in the room, with everybody else catering to their desires, simply because there were just so darn many of them. So if they ended up being a little bit narcissistic and thinking the world revolved around them, it's only natural.
You had mentioned already some critique of feminism and that it broke the single paycheck family, for example. But what are some of the other complaints you have about boomer style feminism?
Some people defend the boomers by observing that the divorce rate has since gone down. They say that people criticize the boomers for getting divorced and not having stable families, but clearly that was just a momentary excess and the pendulum has swung back. That's an unfair defense of the boomers. It's false, because the only reason the divorce rate has gone back down is because fewer people are getting married in the first place. We recently, just in the last 3 years, crossed the fateful threshold when a majority of American adults over the age of 16 today are single. For the last century, it has been the case that the majority of adults are married. So it's the millennials who are having just a really hard time pairing off and making a success of settling down and finding partners willing to commit to them. So clearly something is going wrong with the way families are formed.
We have a listener who wants to comment on that specific point, so let me bring the call in now. Trudy in Springfield, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Helen Andrews, the author of Boomers.
Trudy, to briefly digress, to know that the baby boomers inherited institutions that were in perfect functioning order sounds a bit Caucasian for me, but I want to say that I'm not a boomer and I'm not a millennial, so no dog in this hunt.
Okay.
But marriage rates going down, you are welcome. Marriage is a good deal for men. You look at any of the rates. Married women fare worse than single women. Married men fare better than single men. And when you survey, it's young women who don't want to get married. You clearly want to get married, and you can certainly find a young man to do that. But women fare better. Women are doing better. So you are welcome, and have a great day.
Trudy, thanks for the call. Helen, you found somebody who can bring the sharpness like you can.
I love it. But before I answer, I'll have to correct Trudy on something. She said that married men do better than single men. What she's talking about is the fatherhood bonus in terms of income. It used to be the case that married men made more money. That has since disappeared. Yet another symptom of the demise of the one-earner family.
Did she say economically, though, or was it just more to health benefits or things like that? I didn't get a clear read on whether that was just about economics from Trudy.
Well, the real rebuttal that I have to her point, which is well taken, is that recently the statistic was found that 25% of millennial women are on track today to have no children, to end their lives without ever having born a child. And the sad fact of that is that they're childless, these women, not because they want to be, but because they just couldn't get it together to get married. When you poll women and ask them, how many children do you want to have? Do you want to have children at all? The percentage of women who say that they want no kids is generally about 5%. And it's that way for millennial women. 5% of them say, I don't want any kids. But that leaves the other 20% who are on track to end their lives not having any children, who are that way not by choice. And I think that's tragic. That's sad. And I think we should do something to help those 20% of women and fix the American family, because contrary to what Trudy said, it's not because they choose to.
Let's move on from families and feminism to drugs. I mean, where do you see this start with the American love affair with drugs and the result today?
I think a lot of people would be surprised to learn that before the 1960s, you would be very unlikely to find any drugs at all on a college campus. But that's the case. A middle-class person would be very unlikely to encounter anybody who smoked anything as strong as marijuana, much less cocaine or heroin, unless they were a jazz musician or something. Drugs were very much a minority and a minority pastime. A very small number of Americans did drugs. It was the 60s that changed that. And the way that you can tell that the baby boomers were the real drivers of the drug revolution is that the drugs that we identify with each decade map onto what the boomers were doing during them. When they were young and didn't have money in the 60s, they were smoking pot. The drug we associate with the 70s is cocaine because the boomers had a little bit more money. The drug of the 80s was Valium because the boomers were stressed and focusing on their careers. And in the early 90s is when we saw the rise of Ritalin and Adderall, because I strongly believe that you can't tell the story of the drug revolution without also including prescription drugs and psychiatric drugs in particular, because you wouldn't have a world today where nearly 25% of white women are on antidepressants without the revolution in illegal drugs that the boomers brought about.
Helen, is it useful or even possible to parse out some stuff in terms of whether this came from a generation of people or whether it came from a field of people? In other words, because the medicalization of so many problems in America, where you do have a pill for just about everything that ails you, can certainly be blamed upon the pharmaceutical industry. Is that necessarily coming primarily from one generation, though?
It is. It is. I do blame the boomers for it specifically. And the rise of Ritalin in the 90s is a good example of why. Because there's something more to the overprescription of Ritalin to it than just wanting to solve a problem with a pill. The boomers, as a generation, are generally averse to exercising authority. And especially as parents, the boomers are really do like to be the cool mom or the cool dad. But the early 90s, when the boomers had their first young school-aged children, was when they began to realize that you can't parent a young 8-year-old without exercising a parent. Sometimes you gotta impose a little discipline. So the baby boomers were caught in a dilemma. On the one hand, wanting to be cool and not exercise discipline, but on the other hand, needing to impose some kind of order on their kids. And Ritalin and Adderall were their way of solving that dilemma without needing to sacrifice their own narcissistic sense of themselves as cool parents who weren't tough disciplinarians like their parents had been. So that's something, it wasn't just the pharmaceutical industry going around and pushing Ritalin, although you're right, they certainly did that. It was that the boomers wanted it and demanded it for, I think, really very selfish reasons.
Helen Andrews is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an essayist, senior editor at the American Conservative, and author of the book Boomers, The Men and Women Who Promised Freedom and Delivered Disaster. We haven't gotten to the individual six profiles that make up the core of the book: Steve Jobs, Aaron Sorkin, Jeffrey Sachs, Camille Paglia, Al Sharpton, and Sonia Sotomayor. But you can join the conversation here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to at least take one pass at pop culture because it was so huge. You know, we had, and you still have, the Rolling Stones on tour. Paul McCartney just released a new album. Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So the boomers really, really made the main stage of pop culture for decades. I must admit, though, having a sixth Gilligan's Island movie probably wasn't the best thing that came out. But you do say that pop culture helped bring down communism. Do you count that as something of a boomer victory?
Absolutely. And I should make very clear to every listener out there that this is not just a boomer bashing book. I do try and highlight some of the things that I admire about them. And the music, wow, that's definitely at the top of the list. The boomers, gotta admit it, had really great music. That's been driven home to me recently. I just had my first child in the last year. And when I was making little playlists for what I wanted to put on the radio to soothe my kid, you know, I wasn't putting on the indie music that was big when I was 16. I was putting on Cat Stevens and James Taylor. Huh. So give credit where it's due. The boomers had some great music.
Talk about the effect on politics, though. As you pointed out, the left of the 1960s is not the left of today, and which makes me ask further, how about the right?
The right has changed as well. But it's been most noticeable in the left, and also most tragic, the boomer takeover of the left. And we really should have seen it coming, because in the 1960s, right at the beginning of their period of political influence, the boomers called themselves the New Left. And the reason they did that was to distinguish themselves from the old left. If you read the Port Huron Statement or the writings of Tom Hayden or Abby Hoffman or any of the other new left figures, you will find that they said very disparaging things about unions and working class people, and they considered them reactionaries and traitors to the revolution that the 60s generation was going to bring about. What that ended up doing was divorcing the Democratic Party and all the left-wing parties of all the Western democracies. You see the same thing in Britain and France and Australia and everywhere else. A divorce between these parties and their old constituency of working-class people. So the boomers think of themselves as being the most left-wing and idealistic generation in history, but their actual effect on the left-wing parties has been to cause them to ignore and abandon the working class that the left is supposed to be the champions of.
Jeff in Ashland emails on this particular realm, and he says, I'm curious why your ire seems so squarely skewed toward left-leaning individuals as if conservative boomers had no hand in the outcome.
It's true, but the thing about conservative boomers is that they were liberal in their own way. Boomers were an important and a fundamental part of the Reagan Revolution. But if you think about it, Reagan was very unconservative in many ways. He was all about liberating individual choice and the individual being the most important unit of society and freedom being the highest value at the expense of community or solidarity. And so in the same way that the boomer left wasn't really left, in some ways the boomer right actually was.
Was right or was left?
Was left.
Mm-hmm.
Was left.
All right. So let's start talking about the people that you profile in the book, beginning with Steve Jobs, of course, who was one of the creators of Apple Computer and the person most associated with it to this day, the late Steve Jobs. The section on him begins with a police raid in 2010. About what?
This was when, in one of those strange incidents of fate, an Apple engineer had taken a prototype of the new unreleased iPhone model home with him and then gotten drunk at a bar and drunkenly left it behind him. And somebody came across it, realized what it was, and sold it to a tech blog. So this tech blog had an illegal iPhone prototype. They were not supposed to have it, and they shared pictures of it online and sort of broke Apple's moratorium before the launch of this new product. And Apple sent the police after these poor tech bloggers. And even after the tech blog gave them their iPhone prototype back, they still sent the police after them to raid their apartments to see if there was any more illegal material there. So Apple presents itself as this cool hippie company, but when its own interests are threatened, they can be just as authoritarian as anybody else.
Well, talk too, if you would, about big tech's reshaping of the labor market. This seems very far from boomer visions of how to take care of people in our own society.
The labor market is very high on the list of millennial complaints in terms of the world that the boomers have left us. Steve Jobs really believed that by putting a computer in everybody's pocket, he was going to liberate human creativity. And that was a laudable goal on his part. And certainly his vision for technology shaped the entire computer industry from the moment Apple was incorporated. He really did succeed in putting a computer in everybody's pocket. The problem was that didn't end up liberating human creativity very much. It left millennials addicted to screens. So many millennials I know play video games for hours and hours on end. And it left us in a labor market where the jobs we have are just more precarious. It's an Uberized economy, which is great if you're a consumer and want to get your food delivered, but not so great if you're the one driving the car and doing the delivery.
So take us into shoulda then. I mean, what should Steve Jobs have done differently that might have resulted in things like not having millennials addicted to screens?
The thing about tragedy is that very often you can't foresee the negative effects. I'm not sure that Steve Jobs should have done anything differently. The dilemma arises in how we react, to these changes and deal with them. I think a lot of millennials would probably want to limit the amount of screen time that they have at their jobs. And so in the future, I think it's probably... we're probably going to see less of laptops in schools and every fourth grader being given an iPad, which is what the boomers are imposing on their kids now. I think it's very telling that most of the tech titans in Silicon Valley very strongly limit the amount of screen time that their own kids have. They insist on an analog upbringing for their own kids. And so that's what I think we should see going into the future, and it will probably be millennials who do that course correction.
Do you see the pandemic helping there? The fact is that everybody's on screens now, but when they get back to schools, they'll probably want to spend a whole lot less time with screens than they did before.
I hope so. On the other hand, the pandemic has supercharged the Uberized economy. Grocery delivery has exploded since the pandemic. More and more people are using Instacart. They've had a very good pandemic. Amazon has had a very good pandemic. The instantaneous delivery of takeout and food and products has been a big part of the middle class's pandemic experience, and I hope a bit of that is able to roll back once this pandemic is all over.
There's an email here from Graham in Ashland who says of you, sounds as if she's stereotyping boomers, be it not boomer bashing, she sounds as if she's lumping all into one basket, even what she likes, such as music. Thanks for having her to make me think. That from Graham in Ashland. So kind of a backhanded compliment there. Let me take a phone call in here as well, and let's get to David in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi, I really appreciate this conversation. I think it's really important to question the past and what's come from it. I would put out there that I don't think the 50s was necessarily a leave it to beaver generation for everybody. There was a lot of alcohol abuse, domestic abuse, spousal abuse, child abuse. Racial abuse was huge. I found it really interesting that you mentioned jazz musicians as the marijuana smokers, because I wanted to actually ask a question about that, because in the 1920s, Harry Anslinger and the Oil and Timber Corporations pretty much made marijuana illegal and put a very racist war against marijuana, and you seem to think that somehow that this 60s and 70s liberal movement has created this drug problem. I'm wondering if you looked at the racist origins of the war on drugs and its implementation specifically with regards to cannabis, and the mention of jazz musicians was really like history coming back. It was like Harry Anslinger being quoted in the 21st century.
All right. Thank you for that, David. Appreciate that. Your thoughts, Helen?
Well, I think that it's true that the drug war has had a racist connotation at various points in its history, including, as the caller said, in the 1920s. But there are plenty of non-racist reasons to be very disturbed by the proliferation of drugs. I think millennials are growing up in an America where there are entire communities where every single individual knows somebody who has died of an overdose, or knows somebody who's throwing their life away because they're a pothead. And so just the individual experience of millennials, we know from our lives that drugs ruin people, that drugs kill people, and we don't need any racist campaign from anybody to tell us that. That's something that we can see with our own two eyes.
Another email here from Elizabeth, no town given, who writes, when I left graduate school at UC Berkeley in 1968, I did not want to get married until later and very much wanted a career that I'd enjoy and that would pay enough to not make me a wage slave. As it happened, I very much wanted to work in broadcasting. I applied to nearly every television broadcast station and several radio stations. Sex discrimination was not yet illegal, and without exception, every potential employer turned me away because, quote, you're overqualified to be a secretary and we wouldn't hire a girl to be anything else, close quote. This may be feel that my chosen path to the future was permanently and unfairly blocked. Luckily, within a year or so, Title VII was enacted, and I was one of 20 chosen for a public television training program and went on to a successful career as an Emmy Award-winning television producer-director. That from Elizabeth, no town given.
So, well, I certainly don't have any quarrel with that story, and it's quite an inspiring one. I would never want to deny that things were not all rosy for the housewives of the first generation of feminists. On the other hand, when I look at feminist writers like Betty Friedan, you know, something a lot of people don't know about her is that she claimed that her book was based on a survey taken of fellow graduates from her class at Smith College, and that the survey of Smith alumni showed that Smith College women felt aimless, and this was the problem that had no name, as Betty Friedan put it. Well, since that book came out, people have hunted down the original Smith survey that Betty Friedan purported to be basing her book on, and found that actually the housewives that responded to that survey reported being extremely happy. And they said, I feel like I could go work if I wanted to, but I don't want to. My life as a housewife is great. So even Betty Friedan, one of the original feminists, had to misrepresent her own data to present the housewife's fate as being some terrible, horrible thing. And I just don't trust people who feel the need to lie.
We come back to the email from Elizabeth, which prompted these comments, which takes us to another television producer, Aaron Sorkin, who is one of the six people you shaped the book around. I mean, did The West Wing, his major accomplishment, train a generation of political operatives, in essence?
I know for a fact that it did, because I am exactly the right age to have watched The West Wing in high school and college, which meant that half of the people I knew in the Yale Political Union or in Washington, D.C., when I moved down here after school, went into politics because they watched The West Wing. And now I see other people from my generation rising up the ladder at the Justice Department or the Democratic Party or consultancies here in Washington, and they're still living their lives as if they were West Wing characters, which is in many ways a disturbing quality for a ruling class to have, to see their own power as being something like a TV show.
Well, so talk about Aaron Sorkin's own views on the power of television and his own powers of comprehension. It sounds like he was rather modest about thinking that he had the power to change the world or anything like that.
He absolutely was, and that's what's so tragic about it. He never wanted to be Pied Piper to a generation of political consultants. When The West Wing was on the air, interviewers would try to ask him about politics or engage him in political debate, and he always said, with a really very attractive modesty, "I'm not terribly political. I've only set my show in politics because I like the sound of intelligent people talking to each other, and it seemed like a really good venue for dialogue." The thing that Aaron Sorkin does care passionately about is television and the power of television, which is why of the four TV shows that he's made in his career, only one is about politics. All of the other three, Sports Night, Studio 60, and The Newsroom, were about television. So even though Aaron Sorkin doesn't care all that much about politics himself, he says, he's perfectly well aware of the power of TV shows, because that's something that he returns to again and again in his work.
Another comment here from a listener. Aaron in Humboldt is on the phone. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Helen Andrews.
Hi. It's hard to hear you guys. I turned off my radio. I'm assuming that's a good thing.
It is. We can hear you fine, though.
Okay, now I can hear you fine. Okay, so let me try to be very specific. I'm not going to connect all the dots because there's too much and there's no time. Number one, this author seems to be non-cognizant of Robert Bly's The Sibling Society. So I'll put that forth as a book that people might want to look into. And what it outlines is how advertising, in an effort to get their hands on money of unformed brains, as in teenagers, which had not really been a thing prior to this period of time where, and I'm going to go all the way back, people won't know what I'm talking about, but Blondie in the comic strips and the newspapers, Dagwood was a buffoon of a husband. Mm-hmm. The idea was to break up the monopoly on authority in the nuclear family so that people would feel that they could spend money without asking Dad. And this is all the way back to the 30s. Then later, you have in the 50s a wave of the same against Mom. Now Mom's the buffoon, and so finally by the time you get to the 60s, you've got children who feel, first they have money, which they didn't, and they don't feel that they need to consult with their parents for any kind of verticality of wisdom as to what to do with that money. So they have allowances, or they finally get some jobs that aren't, you know, like during the Depression, having to go into the family survival. And so there is this attention to the unformed brain. I do have a degree in cognitive science, so most people aren't aware that our brains are continuing to grow throughout our life. That's a myth, with the okay. idea that they don't. But the thing is that she is not looking at the way the boomers were set up, and this was not of their own doing. And she seems to have lost the track of a certain amount of historical time. Ritalin being pushed and pushed hard was happening in the 60s to the pre-boomer mothers and fathers for their boomer children. Mm-hmm. This was essentially an epidemic of control of children's vitality.
Okay, Aaron, I'm going to stop you here. I'm sorry about that. But I think we've got your point pretty well in hand now. I want to get some response from Helen because we're running short on time. Thank you, Aaron.
I love what the caller said about advertisers wanting to beguile unformed minds, not because they wanted to liberate them, but because they wanted to liberate dollars from their wallets. I think that's a running theme you see again and again in the boomer history, presenting their revolutions as liberating and cool when the underlying motivation was something a lot more selfish.
I want to read some emails here. Let's see. Still booming in talent writes, time to grow up and stop blaming your parents. Steve in No Talent Given writes, the boomers entered a conformist racist nation. We noticed the people living in houses made of ticky-tacky and decided we didn't want to grow up to be the man in the gray flannel suit. We noticed racial discrimination and began the civil rights movement. We experimented with drugs and in some cases did have revelations. We didn't want to live the lives of our fathers and mothers. Women of our age wanted to enter the workforce. We wanted to get out of the daily 40-hour week grind. Not that it turned out perfectly. Trump is a boomer, says Stephen, which is not quite true. Well, actually, Trump is a boomer. It is Joe Biden who's not a boomer. My apologies. Ken in Ashland writes, my big problem with my generation is that we sold out in terms of our consumerism. We marched against the Vietnam War, but we also marched against the status quo of our parents' lifestyles. As soon as we boomers get into making money, we started building giant houses, driving Mercedes-Benzes instead of Cadillacs, and buying crap as a sport. We left behind our care of the planet and the lesser among us, particularly people of color. We did not fulfill our promise to change the world economically, nor did we end war. Call me disappointed in my generation, writes Ken and Ashland. So there's quite a sampling there, Helen.
There's a lot there. One of the most interesting books I read in the research for this book was one called The Hero's Children, which was about the baby boom generation behind the Iron Curtain. Because the Soviet Empire had a baby boom generation after the war, the same way we did. And the interesting thing that I learned from this book is that all of the Soviet baby boomers describe having the same conversation with their parents. They say, we can always almost get our parents to agree that communism is bad. But whenever we try and convince them that the society they're living in is corrupt and wrong and a bad system, they always say, but you don't want things to go back to the way they were before, do you? And that was kind of a mental block. They couldn't understand the idea that you could have a society that was neither communism nor the corrupt, feudal, reactionary system that had existed before. So I would have thought nothing would be easier than to convince somebody living in Czechoslovakia in 1968 that communism is bad. But this mental block of you don't want things to go back to the way they were before, do you? Just prevented them from seeing it. I sometimes worry that that's the way we treat the boomers now. We say, well, the world before the boomers was really terrible. Therefore, everything the boomers have done since then must be right. And we must keep the boomer revolution. When, just as with communism in 1968, probably their system deserves to be undone. No matter how terrible the thing that went before was.
I think what I hear you saying here then, Helen, is that this requires is a greater degree of imagination than any generation has really been bringing to the fore at this point.
That's right, and that's why millennials need to liberate themselves from the boomer mindset. We, my generation, still allow boomers to define our idea of what's cool and what's noble. And I think we need to break free from that, and we're not going to have real progress until we do.
Would any subsequent generation, though, no matter how good the accomplishments of that generation, with the possible exception of the so-called greatest generation of the Second World War, would any subsequent generation resent their priors?
It's only natural that they do, and I fully anticipate that when my little boy grows up, he'll resent my generation, and maybe he'll write a book about how terrible the millennials are. And that was my mission as I undertook to write this manuscript. I really wanted to sort out which complaints I had about the boomers were fair and which ones were not fair, because I don't want to blame the boomers for anything that isn't their fault, and I hope this book doesn't.
All right. It's a fun read, and we certainly sparked quite a bit of discussion here on the Jefferson Exchange. We thank you for that. Helen Andrews is the author of Boomers, The Men and Women Who Promised Freedom and Delivered Disaster. Helen, thanks again.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you.